Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is a poet, Richard Jones. Richard is an accomplished poet in his own right, and he is also the editor of a review called Poetry East, which is put out by DePaul University, has been going for 40 years, is celebrating their 40th anniversary, and it's a compilation of varying kinds of poetry by many, many different poets. Fascinating. All different styles, all different subjects, and it's a fascinating book to read. But we'll be both talking about those, Poetry East, and his own poetry. Richard Jones, With Respect. Richard, how are you today?
I'm doing just fine. How are you tonight?
I am fantastic, even though it's a bit of rain hitting my windows. It's a little bit mystical, maybe just the right time for a talk about poetry.
I agree. I'm looking at the same cloudy skies and same mist-laden trees.
Richard, where are you from originally?
Well, you know, that's a great question to start with because it's a difficult one for me to answer. My father was in the Air Force, and I was actually born in London when he was stationed in England. And so my childhood was a bit peripatetic. We moved around quite a bit. From London, we came to Portsmouth, Virginia, from there to Cape Cod, Massachusetts, to Nova Scotia, Canada, down to Savannah, Georgia, a time in North Carolina, and finally, I ended up in Virginia. So when people ask me that, and I want to give them the short answer, I say I'm from Virginia.
All right, but that, how many minutes or days did you have in your life where you're actually in Virginia? It sounds like you had a lot of time around the world.
We traveled quite a bit, and there's a part of me that's really grateful for that. I think gave me a sensibility that by the time I finally settled down, I sort of had developed a sensibility of being a tourist. Like I was always in some place new. I was always wide-eyed. I was always curious, sometimes a little shy, but I was always open to the world. Like we got to Virginia after my father retired from a full career as a major in the Air Force, and we got to Virginia and about just before I went into junior high school.
Tell me about your father and mother. What were they like?
Well, my father, I can't tell you how much I admire him. Now, he's gone on. He's passed away probably about 14 years now. He was a pretty extraordinary person. He was a gentleman. He was stoical. He was a man of few words until you asked him to tell a story. And then he could regale the entire room with a story. I remember growing up and he would tell stories about the war. And I used to sit wide-eyed at these because, you know, I looked at my father just as a normal man who came home every day at the end of the day and, you know, had dinner and we all sat down and talked about our day. But every now and then he would tell a story from World War II that would just knock my socks off. It would, and I've always sort of compared myself to him. I mean, he was a true hero. You know, he won the Distinguished Flying Cross. He logged in over 1 million miles. He flew 180 missions. So sometimes I think about the work that I do, sitting quite safely at my desk And I think of the things my father did when he was young, and I'm pretty much in awe of him. So he and I had a great relationship. But one thing that I would say is he was from that generation that was not necessarily a generation of talkers, if you know what I mean. He was a man of action and of deed. If he wanted you to know that he loved you, he would do something for you. He would find a way to show you. Whereas when I was coming along, you know, I was a budding poet. I wanted to talk. I wanted words. Mm-hmm. And so we had that tension that I think is very familiar to a lot of American men, to a lot of American fathers and sons from that particular generation. And I think still today, people still talk about it. But my father was someone that I now look up to probably more than I did than when he was alive. You know, I recognize things about him, his sacrifices, his love, that certainly as a young man, I just didn't have the depth or wisdom to appreciate. I didn't have the life experience and knowledge. And, you know, when you have children of your own, your perspective changes on things and you realize, oh my goodness, this man lived a very rich and deep, complex life. I think he lived life to the full. But again, I learned so much from him, and in part, that sense of my father was a Southerner. He was a Virginian, which is why we ended up in Virginia. My mother was from North Carolina, and I learned from him, I think, among other things, you know, how to look someone in the eye, how to shake their hand, and to be good to people. You know, that was something that he lived the golden rule. He did unto others as he would have them do unto him. And that lesson has stayed with me and sometimes haunts me because I don't always live up to it every day.
Well, I can understand that.
He was a pretty extraordinary man.
One of the things I hate to use this word without precision, but trope that men don't share their deep feelings easily.
It's quite true.
But it is quite true. And I think that it was true of my father. I would get stories from him, and he was a great story. I mean, I'm listening to you and saying, that's my dad, because he was a great storyteller. Mm-hmm. But when it came to ask him, did you love mom? And that was a question asked late in life. And he looked at me like I was speaking Greek, and he said, well, of course I did.
Sure.
And I asked, here's a guy who very rarely used my name. That is, it was always just he'd start up a statement, and you just knew who he was talking to.
Sure.
The key events that he, in life, that where he became prescient about things, he would start off by saying, John. I think, okay. But it's interesting that you noticed that about your dad. How about your mom? What was she like?
Well, my mother was from North Carolina, so we had an interesting house of accents. My father had a Tidewater accent, so his voice would drawl a little bit slower. And his vowels would drop down way low. Mm-hmm. Whereas my mother was from Carolina and her people had all come from Scotland. So her accent had a bit more of a twang to it, the way you might imagine something coming from Scotland would sound. The main thing, the salient feature about my mother, the thing that was the real touchstone between us was that my mother was deaf. She lost her hearing around the time I was born, in fact, and it wasn't until many years later that she finally got hearing aids. The technology was not quite there yet. The hearing aids that she had were very old-fashioned. She had a sort of a little box that she would pin to her blouse and a pair of earphones that would run up to her ears, And that's how she would hear. And when I was very little, before she had her headphones, hearing aids, she would literally hold my face in her hand sometimes and read my lips when she really wanted to be sure what I was saying. Mm-hmm. So my mother and I had, like my father and I had a great relationship. Like, he and I could play pitch and catch in the backyard. You know, he taught me how to play baseball, and we would play until his hand would burn red, you know, just throwing pitches all evening long. So he and I had an intimate relationship, but also one that had this distance between us because of language. Mm-hmm. And my mother and I had a very intimate relationship. I think because of her lack of being able to hear me, that she had to come closer. She had to really be sure she understood what I was saying. So my mother was very wise, very, very stoical. I think of her as being someone who really enjoyed life. I mean, for her, there wasn't a day that went by that didn't involve some laughter. She was also a very emotional woman. She could get angry. She was someone who could be touched quite deeply. So whereas my father was very stoical, my mother had that part of her that was able to withstand a great deal, but would nonetheless reveal it. And my mother was the opposite side of the coin, whereas she loved to talk. So she loved to sit down, as long as it was just the two of us and there wasn't too much ambient noise and she could hear me with her hearing aids. We were good to go. I have a poem that I wrote about being probably around 12 or 13. So, a young kid, and I asked her, I said, "Mom, can I listen to your hearing aids?" And she said, "Sure, of course you can." So she took off this contraption that she had buttoned to her blouse and gave me that, which I held in my hand, and I put the earphones in. And she stood across the room and she said, "I love you, Richard." And it was one of the most beautiful and terrifying moments of my life, because it was beautiful because that's what she chose to say to me when she could have said anything. I mean, there are a million choices of what she could have said. But she affirmed our relationship. But what was terrifying about it was the way her voice came into my ears. It was like I was listening. You know, I come from the generation where as kids we had transistor radios.
Right.
And you would try and pick up a radio station from two states away, and it would be filled with static and electric crackling. And that's how her voice was. It was very, it was not human. It wasn't the way she spoke normally. It wasn't that beautiful Southern accent that was dripping with honey that I love so much. Instead, it was this very metallic, otherworldly kind of voice. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness, that's how my mother hears me.
Yeah.
So I think it's so interesting to me that you've asked about my mother and father to start, because I think they had so much to do with my becoming a poet. Because I wanted to write poems that my father would hear, and I wanted to write poems that my mother would hear. You know, that was really important to me to make sure I was communicating to them. And even as a young person, I would show them my poems, and they really had no idea what to make of this young man who was writing poems, but they would read them, and sometimes they would go, "Oh, well, that's very good." And my mother, actually, though deaf, had a very good ear. She could play piano strictly, you know, quote unquote, by ear. She never took lessons, but she could sit down and just play all evening long. And she was very good at helping me with the music of my poetry. She'd say, "You know, this line right here, you can make this line sound a little bit better." And that was always very interesting. And my father was usually just very affirmative, very much like, "I hear your story." And I think that that's what both sons and daughters want from their parents, is to be heard. But it's certainly what a poet wants, is to be heard and to be understood. I think that's really, really crucial.
Absolutely true. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Richard Jones, who is a poet and also the editor of a publication from DePaul University in Chicago called Poetry East. We'll be talking about that later. This is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Richard Jones, who is a poet and also the editor of Poetry East, a magazine of national, international poems taken from people around, poets around the world, and they're celebrating their 40th anniversary. Richard, how Yes. about after you just developed this interest in poetry, when did that start? How soon in life?
Well, you know, that's another story that brings us back to my mother, because of my, you know, parents can be great at revisionist history. And according to her, when I was, you know, barely knee high, I was writing odes to nature and so forth. I don't remember it that way, but I do remember starting to write poems in high school. And I didn't even really know that they were poems. The thing about it, though, is that I always wrote in lines. I didn't write in my journal or in my diary in regular paragraphs. I wrote everything in lines and with line breaks. And it wasn't really until I got to college, until I woke up to the fact that there were poets in the world. I almost thought that poets were an anachronism, something from the past. I didn't realize that there was still a vital life of poetry here in the United States and around the world, for that matter. So I suppose that the place where it became most serious was when I moved to New York City in around 1980 and decided that I wanted to be a poet and decided to start a journal and really just devoted myself to what that life would mean. And I have to tell you, I had no idea what the life would mean. I had no idea how I would make my living necessarily. I had no idea how I certainly never planned to do my journal for 100 issues. I was just going to do a few of them and sort of learn the craft. But I'd say it was in my early 20s, which seems to me the natural place for most people to begin. You know, we write our childhood poems, but really by the time when we're early 20s, you know, we're really confronting those questions about who am I, what is truth, how can I live in this world, how can I give something to this world, those kinds of questions that start stirring in all of us. And for some of us, you know, everybody has a way of dealing with that, but for some of us, like myself, writing poetry seemed to be the way to grapple with those essential questions of being.
Well, poetry is the use of words in a particular mm-hmm. way to describe something, whether it's an emotion or it's an event or it's a relationship or a person or the sky or something in nature or in some cases just who am I and where? What is my place in this world, in this universe?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's all done with the use of words.
Right, right.
Words juxtaposed, put together in different forms. And sometimes I think that they are put together to be read verbally or sometimes not to be read orally, but rather just to be thought. I don't know. Am I wrong in that?
No, I think you're right on the money in terms of what a poet is doing and what a poem is. All we have are words. I mean, it's like a painter has colors and a musician has notes. So once you know your medium, you can start going to work. But one thing that you said there at the start is that these words, trying to find the right words, that's extremely important. The last thing you want to use is the wrong words, because then people won't know what you're talking about. So you have to be articulate. You have to be precise. I mean precise, like the way a mathematician or a scientist or a brain surgeon must be precise. You can't be sloppy in any way, shape, or form. You have to be, you know, just right on the money with your language, and then you have to get it in the right order with the right rhythms. So this is basically speech at its most elevated and its most articulate. That doesn't mean that it's rare, because there are moments, and we know them in life, like when someone stands up at a funeral to give a eulogy, they're not giving a poem. They're speaking at their most eloquent, at their most sincere, and with great precision to capture the moment of loss. So I think that idea that poetry is about choosing the right words is absolutely essential. And the other thing that you mentioned is that we're telling stories, and we're telling stories about things that we can look at and see. And I think one thing that a lot of people have a misconception about with poetry is they think that the camera, so to speak, turns inward to find the words. But really, if you simply look out at the world, like as I look out right now, I see the pine trees. I can see the raindrops at the ends of the needles of the trees. I can see the clouds rushing across beneath the cherry trees that are just coming into bloom. So if I turn my eyes outward, I find the right words to use. So that helps the reader to see. So it's been said, this is not original to me, but it's been said that poetry is a way of seeing. It's a way of looking. And the trick is to give the words that help people see what you want them to see.
Now, words of themselves don't get us very far. Even you could get the right word. Friends of mine have refrigerators, and they have these magnetic words stuck all over.
Right.
And they move them around just as they, but sitting on alone, mixed up, without any order to them, they don't help you very far.
That's exactly right.
But so it's putting them together in the right order. And we haven't even talked yet about one of the things that I'm fascinated by, and we will talk a little bit later about the different things called meter or rhythm. But you'd have to put them in some kind of an order, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sitting in my study, and I can look across at my bookshelves, and I see these two giant Oxford English dictionaries filled with thousands and thousands of words. So you have to find the right ones. A lot of it is not really very mysterious. I mean, if you're going to tell a story about, like if I were going to write a poem about my mother, you know, I remember as a child coming home and finding her ironing my father's white Oxford shirts. And because she was deaf, she didn't know I was there. But I could stand and watch her doing that. So once I have the memory, Wordsworth said that memory is very, very important. And memory will give you the words. You know, poets might be prophets and they might be seers, but really, I think they have good memories, and they're able to find the right word. One of the definitions of poetry that I like is that the poet is the one who originally named all the flowers. So that to be able to name something, to be able to speak it clearly so that everyone will know exactly what you're talking about is really important. And then there's these different valences and nuances that word have, like a word like nature. If I say that, people are going to picture all kinds of things. They'll picture Yellowstone Park, they'll picture a running brook, they'll picture daffodils coming up in the spring. But that's a pretty broad word, and I'm leaving my reader a lot of room there. Whereas if I say pine tree dripping with raindrops, then you're going to see the exact image that I'm talking about. To give another example, sometimes I'll have my students, I'll say, okay, I want everyone to close their eyes and think of a window. And so they all close their eyes and everyone thinks of a window. Then I say, okay, everybody open your eyes and let's go around the circle and everyone tell me what kind of window you saw. And no two windows are the same. You get, you know, stained glass windows in a church. You get the little attic window in the poet's garret. You get a porthole on the side of a ship. You get a window that's cut inside a door so you can open it up and see who's on the other side. You get all kinds of windows. So a lot of this conversation about words is finding the right word, the exact word for the right job, the right tool for the right job. And that, I think, is very much the poet's task, to keep the language alive and vital and vibrant simply by paying attention and using the proper nouns and verbs.
I want to toss out a couple of poems to you, and we're going to go back just in our next segment and talk about the history of poetry, because there is a lengthy history, probably as long as men and women are marching about in this world. There is some form of that. But
sure.
I'll give you two poems. Stopping by the Woods on a Wintry Evening by Robert mm-hmm. Frost mm-hmm. has great images. Can you do that from memory, how it starts?
Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. So you have this starting image of someone who's on a horse carriage, you know, driving in the twilight and stops and looks at the woods as the snow falls so peacefully and beautifully through the branches. It's Frost is such a marvelous painter of the scene, and talking about someone who picks exactly the right words. He goes on to say, my little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. You know, it's just very natural, fluid speech that he can use.
One of the things he did not do a lot of is use a lot of er and nor and ancient words. They were all very everyday words, just put into the right framework. And then we're going to talk in a little bit about its cadence, how it's mm-hmm. put together. And mm-hmm. I remember that poem. I loved that poem. And the final stanza ends up, I don't know what, basically, I can't do the whole stanza, but he says, well, I can't stay around. My horse is getting nervous, and right. we got to go on.
Yes.
But I have miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
Yes, it's a beautiful repeated last line.
Yes, mm-hmm. over and over. You think about that line, and you toss it around. Another one of his poems, I came to a path and a fork in the path, and it's the road not taken is the poem.
Right.
By him. And if you look at that poem, there's all kinds of image words, but mm-hmm. it really, at the end of it, you say, wait a minute, he's talking about life and choices that we have
yes,
to make.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
So there's,
that's a really fascinating poem. Both of those poems are so great because I don't know about you, but I've never ridden in a horse-drawn carriage through the woods at night on my own. And yet I read his poem and I feel like I have.
Yes, yes.
We all know what he's talking about when he talks about the road less traveled. They're walking along, you know, a little country road, and suddenly it takes a fork, and clearly more people have gone to the left and fewer people have gone to the right, and you have to make a choice now. It's a fascinating poem because it is most certainly about life. But if you read that poem really carefully, most people think it's about that if I take the road less traveled, I'll have more adventure. And, you know, that must be the right choice. But really, if you read the poem carefully, he says, you know, both of these paths are pretty much equal, but the one you take makes all the difference.
And that's the final line.
Yes.
It made all the difference because I took the road less traveled.
And, that's right.
But he doesn't say whether it was good or ill that came
along. That's exactly right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
We're going to take another break right now. We're talking to Richard Jones, who is a poet, and he has books of his own. Richard Jones put together a series of poems in a book called Stranger on Earth, and another one called Avalon, and another one called Paris. There's a wide range of subject matters that he has taken up in his poetry, and we'll get a lot more to talk about those in a bit. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and we'll be right back. This is John Smetanka. Now, Richard, we've been talking about the use of words, and we've also touched on the rhythm that can get you into the mood mm-hmm. that the poet wants to bring you to.
Yes.
And that's another thing, which is, and I haven't even started to talk about your particular rhythm, which you have, and I'm embarrassed to say that it took me three readings of poems before I realized, oh, wait a minute, he's got a cadence here. Holy mackerel.
Mm-hmm.
My
mm-hmm.
good friend from over the sea I was talking to recently who had, as I read the poem, one of the poems that I thought was wonderful, she said, well, there's a rhythm to that. And it's a cadence, and it's all put together. And I thought, I'm embarrassed to say it took me three poems to figure that out. But at any rate, what does the role of sound and cadence play in getting a message across or getting a description right?
Right. I think it's absolutely crucial. And in terms of getting, you know, two or three readings before you recognize In our case, you know, my particular cadences, even if they'd been, when I read a sonnet by Shakespeare, you know, the first thing that I'm not looking for is necessarily the cadence or meter. I'm looking for what he's trying to say. So for my first two or three readings, and I hope that on your first two or three readings, you at least knew what I was trying to say.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And then you realize, well, why did you read it the second and third time? Well, if you get it the first or at least the second time, why read it a third time? Why are we reading Robert Frost stopping by woods on a snowy evening for the millionth time? And it's because there's something about these rhythms and this music that is a kind of human breath, you know, the river of breath where these narratives flow downstream to us. You know, we love them so much. So getting the cadence and the rhythm catches your reader's ear. And if you can catch their ear, then quite probably you can also capture their mind and their imagination.
Because you are using multiple media to get through to the brain, to the soul of the listener and the reader.
Yes, yes. So I think that's why people talk about composing a poem, which is what you think of, well, isn't that the domain of the musician who composes a piece on their violin or on their piano? But a poet composes a poem so that those rhythms, which are underscored by your use of line break, your punctuation, any kind of caesura or stops in the middle of the line. All these things contribute to the drama of the poem. Ultimately, that's what we're really after. You wouldn't want to go to a poet who writes in strict meter and say, oh, I love your iambic pentameter. You know, really what you want to say is, you know, I love your poem about stopping by the woods on a snowy evening. And I felt that I was right there with you, and that experience was just magical. So thank you for giving me that story. So ultimately, it's the story that we're after. But what poets are so acutely aware of is that we need to make the language musical so that people will want to hear it again and again. Because once we have just the information of the poem, there's no real reason to read it again. I mean, I read a column in the sports section, but I don't clip it out and read it again and again and again and again. But a poem I can go back to repeatedly. I mean, all of your listeners listening to the show right now, I bet to a person they have a composer or a musician that they just need to hear and love to hear, you know, again and again and again. They've heard the same song for the thousandth time, and yet it still feels brand new. And right. There's something in poetry that we go back to poems that we know what they're about, we know what they're saying, and yet they can touch us freshly. And to me, that's really the way to think about what a masterpiece is. I live just north of Chicago, so I can go down to the Art Institute, and I've seen all the paintings there. I've been here for 30-some years, and I love the Art Institute. But I can go back and stand in front of the same paintings for another half an hour and just say to myself, this painting is remarkable, as if I'm looking at it for the first time. So this conversation we're having about a writer and especially a poet trying to get words in the right order with the right sense and the right sound, this is all for the sake of the reader. This is all for the sake of the person who's going to hear the poem, who's going to see the poem, who's going to read and decipher that composition you've made as if they knew how to read music and could read a piece of music on a sheet of paper. It's that beautifully and wonderfully complex, and yet it's something children can do. I mean, children can read Robert Frost. Young people can read Robert Frost. We can all read Robert Frost. It's a remarkable, kind of miraculous thing when you think about it, that you can put words on a page, and eventually we're going to take them inside us where we won't even need the page anymore because we know the poem by heart. That's pretty remarkable. So I think you're so on target about the importance of words. And if poetry does nothing else, and I think it does many, many things, but if it does nothing else, it puts us back in touch with our best speech, our most essential speech. And that puts us back in touch with our most essential humanity and our most essential human experiences. Well,
let me stop you right there, because you're now... You've touched that magic word, humanity, all right? And humanity is something which has not just come into account, into existence last week.
No.
it has come back. We've had humanity around for a long time. And how long we had poetry? How long has humanity used or produced poetry, if you know? I mean, tell us from your own experience.
Well, my feeling on that is I use my imagination a little bit. And I know one thing for sure, that human beings love stories. And we know from the cave paintings in France that people would draw stories of going out for the hunt. We know that we have ancient poems that tell stories of great heroes or stories of the gods. So I can picture all the way back to the point where, long before we had written word or texts, where people would sit together around a campfire at night, you know, maybe in a cave, maybe that far back, maybe that primitively, and they would clap or they would pound a stick on a log, and the shaman or the witch doctor or the prophet or the poet of the tribe would stand up and tell the story of the tribe. So I think it's absolutely something essential to our being. I think it kind of goes without saying. And when you think how far back poems go, that we're finding them, you know, such ancient texts. And when you think of the sacred texts, how old they are, clearly there's something that, you know, marks humanity, you know, both today and, you know, and, you know, a million years ago, we're marked by our use of speech. We are developed by our use of speech. We progress and evolve and grow because of speech. We think, we learn about the world through language. Language is an experience. It's not an academic exercise. And we know, just if you look at kids, you know, they love to go and listen to someone stand up on the stage with a microphone and do a hip hop song or a rap song. And it's a very ancient kind of poetry. It's all rhyming, you know, it's telling a story, it's telling a narrative, and everyone in the audience is pumping their fists. You know, so no matter what incarnation you think of, I think there's something about this storytelling that holds us wrapped, that holds us enthralled. It puts a spell on us and sparks our imagination so that we can live something that's bigger than ourselves, or find a poet who speaks in ways that helps us understand better who we are.
You know, I'm going to add something here, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember reading somewhere or other that the many of the, as you mentioned, the sacred texts or the histories of the sagas of the kings came from people who were sensitive to the fact that they had to have a record, that we wanted to know, everybody wants to see that they have left a mark on this world. And the one way of doing that is by teaching the young, teaching the young about their ancestors. But I understand that in some of those sagas, they were used as, for example, in the scripture, Christian scripture, Jewish scripture, they talk about, and Adam begat Jacob, or begat Cain and Abel, and then the begats,
one
after the other, and listing one generation after another. And but I have a vision of somebody, and I also think about the same thing in the terms of the Greeks, sitting with a bunch of kids sitting around a stone or a wood fireplace, and the older man is saying, "All right, now let's get it straight. Who did Adam beget? Adam begat da 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 da." And there's a rhythm as it goes, and that rhythm helps the memory of the
absolutely.
So again, rhythm and cadence and data can all be put together into something that people can tell the story of humanity.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think that, you know, there's a word, the word didactic.
Yes.
And it simply means to teach. Mm-hmm. And certainly much ancient poetry was quite didactic. But as you say, you're teaching about your culture. You know, you're teaching about the generations that came before you. You might be teaching about simply how to live, how to run a working farm, or how to raise sheep, you know, that kind of thing. Excuse me. So I think that didactic aspect of poetry, that they realized that if they rhymed it, that people would remember it. And so those two things started to come together. And so that notion of poetry has something to say that's important for us to remember. And it's important, if it's going to be remembered, to put it in memorable speech. So we're not necessarily writing poems about the generations or sacred texts or didactic poetry, although there still are some. I've read some poems that, you know, can include some really great food recipes inside them. So that's teaching me something right there, right?
Oh, yeah.
But we do want to, you know, as we think about modern poets and contemporary writers, we're trying to show something about the human experience that can't be found now today just in the history books or just in sacred texts, but that something that can be quite mundane if we write about it with mindfulness, with attention, paying close attention to detail, that there's something almost sacred that's going to come up about that, and it's going to resonate and touch everybody.
In the movie Immortal Beloved, it was about mm-hmm. the life of Beethoven. There was a scene which always struck me, and that is Beethoven was sitting deaf as a fence post, but
right.
he was listening to, he was standing watching and feeling the vibrations of music and talking to someone next to him. And the other person who didn't realize he was deaf apparently said, isn't this wonderful? And he said, but it's music. And Beethoven, the words put in Beethoven's mouth is, music opens the door and lets the listener come in to the mind of the composer.
Yes.
And from what you're talking about, I'm seeing that sort of thing. When you have that poem and you've got the person in the rhythm and they love the words, at some point they come into the mind of the composer, the writer, the poet, and they look out through their eyes at
yes.
at the world or people or events. We're going to take a break right now, and I want you to respond to that when I come back. This is John Smetanka on With Respect, and we've been talking to Richard Jones, a poet and editor of the poetry magazine, a periodical called Poetry East. It's celebrating its 40th anniversary. We'll be right back. Back on With Respect with Richard Jones, a poet in his own right, but also an editor of a journal of poetry from around the world called Poetry East. This is John Smetanka. So when we broke, I tossed that idea that when you write a poem, I'm able to read it and come into your mind. Is this a good image?
I think it's quite accurate. And a very daunting truth, because the question behind that question is, why would someone want to come into my mind?
That's right.
Look through my eyes.
Yeah.
You know, so one needs to be, again, not careful and not cautious, but simply conscious of what one is saying and conscientious in the manner in which one puts the words down on the page. I think Beethoven's absolutely right. There's no way that we would understand anything of Beethoven if he didn't compose those pieces, write them down so that they can be played by musicians across the centuries who can then have some deep understanding of that composer's mind. To me, that we have great poets from Shakespeare to Emily Dickinson, who we can read their poems, and I'm suddenly in the mind of a genius.
Mm-hmm.
I'm suddenly looking through their eyes. Emily Dickinson, you know, she said that the way to tell a good poem is it takes the top of your head off. And boy, she does that almost with every single poem. She just knocks it out of the park. She's just such a home run hitter, you know?
That
you love looking through her eyes. And so what we find is that, you know, poets, it's not so much that Emily or William Shakespeare were, of course, they're geniuses, but it's not so much that they were necessarily special. They simply were doing the things that we're talking about, which is that they were paying very close attention to the language, very close attention to the way they were ordering the words. They had something to say, and they thought about what they wanted to say, just like Frost thinks about what he wants to say. All of these poets, you know, convey meaning. You know, they convey great narrative weight, psychological weight. But when we read them, everyone is pretty much on the same page, that we can all read the same poem and have more or less the same experience. Now, someone who's, you know, 40 years younger than I might read a poem a little bit differently. Someone from a different background might read a poem a little bit differently. But basically, we're reading the same poem, if we're really reading. And I think one thing that we might also talk about is that reading and listening is really a high art form. Again, I think with your audience, you know, they're listening to an hour-long radio show, so they're primed listeners. That's a very high skill that has been developed, to really listen and to hear. So the poet needs to remember that I'm writing for human beings who are remarkable. They can read my words, and if I get them right, we can share an experience. And if we read it collectively, you know, one, the poet has the experience of writing the poem. The reader in isolation reading that poem by him or herself, you know, in their bed late one night, that kind of thing, and they have the top of their head taken off because the poem's so amazing. But then when we begin sharing, as you and I are, along with your audience tonight, you know, sharing, you know, our love of language and our love of certain poems, wow, then the conversation gets very, very big and very, very compelling and interesting, I think. So I like that communal aspect of poetry as well, that we not only get to get inside Beethoven's mind. I most certainly couldn't compose what he composes. So I love giving myself over of an evening, putting him on my stereo and just listening to him. But there's one other thing before we move on, and that's a writer named Franz Kafka. And Kafka said that one of the purposes of literature wasn't necessarily to get inside his mind. He said the purpose of his writing was to break for his writing to be like an axe that breaks the frozen sea within the reader.
Mm.
And I thought that's a nice other side of that coin from Beethoven. Yes, I definitely want to get inside the mind of any great human being who composes at the height of their craft and at the top of their skill, whether it's music or painting or sculpture or architecture, or dance, film, poetry. But I also know that sometimes a work of art of any of those types can come to me and they break something inside me that was frozen, and suddenly it's been opened up, it's been made refreshed, some fresh air has gotten into me, and it expands my consciousness. When I read poems by people who are very unlike me, one thing I really love is poetry in translation. And when I read poems from other times, other cultures, poems by men and women who have lived in places and in circumstances completely different from anything that I've known in my life, I always come away feeling bigger. I feel enlarged. My mind, my heart, my sympathies, my empathy grows for the human experience. I think that's hugely important to keep in mind as well.
And it's a good thing to expand your horizons. It's we all, we've had for a period of time a pandemic in which we've been forced by dint of being afraid of a threat to our very existence to isolate ourselves. And so yeah. Society has also, through its government, said, you got to do this. You got to be isolated. You can't go to work. You can't go to shopping. You can't, whatever. So what do people do? There's a couple of choices. You can sit and stare out the window. You can kick your dog. You can yell at somebody who you're living with. Or on the benign side, you can say, gee, honey, tell me about, you know, your day at the other end of the house.
How was it?
And, yes. But the point is, we can become narrower and narrower and narrower in our perspective. It's like an old-time movie. When they first figured out how to make movies that were at the end of a scene, it would close down slowly.
Right, that narrowing focus.
The narrowing focus and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, if we're not careful, that's what happens to our souls. And yes. I use that in the sense, whatever sense people want to take it, that energizing force within us can become stilted, and so it's a good thing to take some of that time and force ourselves open ourselves to the rest of the world, even though we're stuck in our houses, in our apartments, in our whatever.
Well, John, I think you've really hit on something very important here, because we've been in this most unusual of times. You know, for those of us who are alive and going through this now, this is extraordinary. There have been other times in history, most certainly, when there have been, the Spanish flu of 1919, the plague in England. You know, there have been times when people have had to suffer through things. But you're right. We're in this COVID lockdown, this COVID quarantine. We're isolated from one another. We're losing, among other things, just the art of conversation, because we're being more solitary and quiet than ever before. And I think that's where something like, whether it's poetry or short stories or novels, can really come in such service to the good. Because when I read a poem, I'll often read a poem if it's not because I'm in a good mood or I feel like I want to go better myself. I'll often read a poem because I'm feeling lonely or I'm feeling a little adrift. And when I read something, I find almost every time that if I'm reading something, good writing I'm talking about, that if I read some good writing, there's almost nothing that good writing won't cure in terms of feeling adrift or lost. So I think that poetry, I really love that, for instance, with Poetry East, that I'm able to send that out into the world and people can read these poems and I think feel a little bit less alone, because they read poems that sometimes it's about an experience that they've never had, but sometimes it's something that they too have gone through and they found a poet who has found the words for the experience. And now that has got a kind of beautiful frame around it that is now immortalized, that eternal moment. And it keeps us from feeling quite so lonely or quite so isolated. So I think poetry has been, for me at any rate, I'll speak for myself, something that it's not just that I write poems and edit poems. I read for pleasure. To me, poetry is the great pleasure, one of the great pleasures of life. So I read because I enjoy it. And one reason, in fact, that I teach and that I edit is simply because I find it to be such a joyful, compelling. Now, there are poems that can make me weep like a baby as well. Poems that can move me to tears and just, you know, cut right to the marrow bone. But I'm so grateful for them that I love sharing them. I have a friend in Los Angeles who is a teacher, and someone asked him once, why do you teach? Why do you teach poetry? And he said, well, to me, poetry is just so much fun. He said, I feel like a little kid and I've got this new game or this new toy, but I need other kids to play it with me. So I want to teach them how to play the game.
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want you to come back and do another session with me, because there's so much more to talk about, and I've got surprises for you that you're not ready for yet. I haven't talked to you about it. That that I think both you and the listeners will find interesting. But at any rate, we've been talking to Richard Jones, a poet and the editor and compiler of the Poetry East publication, celebrating its 40th anniversary. This is John Smetanka, Run With Respect, and remember our motto, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.